This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Ray Suarez. Studs Terkel's gift to his country has been to periodically remind us that the great man school of history is dead, that history is not only the story of presidents, generals, princes, and prime ministers. In The Good War, Hard Times, Race, Division Street USA, and now My American Century, history is the story told by miners and maids, steel workers and school teachers, immigrants and industrialists. It's not a revolutionary idea that history is all our stories, but an idea that needs to be reiterated now and then. But you can't just read Studs Terkel's books and get the whole picture of his work. He was a pioneer in the Chicago School of Television with Studs's Place. Far from the glitz of the West Coast and the big budgets of New York, standout programs like Studs' Place and The Today Show and Kukla, Fran, and Ali were born. Terkel worked in the WPA programs for creative artists, working in theater, writing, acting. From WFMT in Chicago, Studs Terkel's radio show was for decades a smorgasbord, a feast for the head, bringing to the audience the fascinating personalities of the day overlooked by Entertainment Tonight. Amidst the radio and the writing, Studs Terkel won a Pulitzer Prize. You could also see him on the silver screen as a skeptical Chicago sports writer in John Sayles' 8 Men Out. Is Studs Terkel a celebrity? Is he a star? Well, not to the people who rode down to the Loop on the Marine Drive bus every morning, not to the people who waved hello as he toddled around the Loop, a stogie in the corner of his mouth, trademark red checkered shirt, unbuttoned at the collar, tie askew. Not bad for a guy born, after all, in New York. But I guess after more than 70 years in Chicago, his ticket is well and truly punched. He is the real thing. The new book, My American Century, is the product of a man who's lived through interesting times and kept his eyes open and his notebook at the ready. Studs Terkel, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Ray. I like your style. By the way, talking to you brings back memories to me of your being in Chicago and being one of those journalists I always have leaned toward, those against the grain, always questioning whoever the authoritative voices are, always questioning. And you've been in that big league all the time.
Well, thank you. You flatter me. Our number in Washington, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. While we're on the subject of being a journalist against the grain, I've heard you speak several times about the great god of journalism, that of even-handedness, of balance, and your idea that sometimes balance is overrated. Why don't you talk to the audience about that?
It's the whole word, that abused, promiscuously misused word, objectivity. There ain't no such animal. When everyone has a point of view, no matter who that journalist is. However, you try to be as fair, as balanced as you can. When you generally say, I am objective, someone is really expressing the point of view of that which is the status quo. If you question it, you're called controversial. You're called subjective. My best friend in England was a great journalist named James Cameron. Ask any young English journalist, British journalist, worth anything, and they'll say his North Star was James Cameron. He was all over the world when he came back from North Vietnam during the Christmas bombings, the first Western journalist to visit Ho Chi Minh during the bombings. He came back with a book, and the book was called This Is Your Enemy, or This Is Our Enemy. It was a simple book proving the North Vietnamese people were humans, not unlike ourselves. He was demolished by the press. The most prestigious of all called him a conduit for Ho Chi Minh. He was saying, I was trying to be objective in my sense as possible. Of course I'm subjective. I was opposed to the war. But I try to be as balanced as I can. When someone says he has no point of view, something is lacking in that person. He could be a computer, but not a flesh and blood being. You try to be. Very often, anybody who challenges authority is called non-objective. And I object that word, objective.
Well, there used to be a press, and it was certainly within much of your lifetime, where when you walked to the newsstand, you could see 7 morning papers, maybe later in the day, a couple of afternoon ones added on, where you knew about the political posture of the publishers of the paper and people, union members or Republicans or people who were against American involvement in World War II, knew that when they picked out a particular paper, they were making a statement about their own beliefs and about what they presumed that paper's beliefs to be. Did we lose something when we lost that kind of press?
When I was a kid in Chicago, we had 7-8 papers. And there were, I must be fair about it, not to romanticize the press. Almost all of them were a conservative in bent, although there were some which we call liberal. And we could talk about those two misused words today, liberal, conservative, that I feel have lost all meaning. But the fact is, fewer and fewer means of communication are in the hands of more and more people. I'll put it the other way. The most powerful means of communication are in fewer and fewer hands. We know that NBC is owned by General Electric, and you don't expect Tom Brokaw to ever criticize General Electric. He'd be out on his ear tomorrow. We know CBS is owned by Westinghouse. You expect Dan Rather to ever criticize Dan Westinghouse? He'd be out on his ear tomorrow. We know Disney owns ABC. You expect Peter Jennings to criticize Disney? So in a sense, we must have something like NPR. We must have something like alternative journalism, whether it be print or electronic. It is essential for what we call a democracy, the idea of an open forum, a free area of opinion expressed wholly. I hope the listeners will call some. I trust will disagree with me. We've got to have that discussion, that argument, of which we hear too little today.
Well, I tell you, I think if we just limit the conversation to your life as a reporter, we'll be missing a couple of things because you've been all over the map. Did you start out to be a journalist, an oral historian, or was your life headed in another direction when the Depression hit?
God, no, my life has been an accretion of accidents. I went to the University of Chicago Law School, three of the most bleak years of my life. No fault of the professors, but I dream of Clarence Darrow, you know, attorney for the damned. And I wake up to contracts and real property was going out of my mind. My dream was, I remember, I'm a Depression boy. My dream was to have a 9-to-5 job, to see a movie or two, see a ball game or two, to see a play or two, to read a book or two. And it happened accidentally. One thing led to another, and I became a hambone actor, a gangster in radio soap operas when Chicago had a great many. I was the one who threatened Ma Perkins, and I was the one who threatened Mary Marlin, who suffered more than St. Teresa ever suffered, Mondays through Fridays, courtesy of Oxydol. Threatened her with a fate worse than death. And I was in all these programs. The scripts were all the same. And then became a disc jockey by accident. Then became a commentator by accident. And thanks to Andre Shiprin, a remarkable publisher, began to do these books based upon conversations with people not celebrated. You know, I've always been influenced by a poem by Bertolt Brecht. And this poem, in a sense, is my credo, or provides it. Bertolt Brecht, a free penny opera with Kurt Weill. He said, well, for example, when you ask who built the pyramids, our first reaction is the pharaohs. Well, the pharaohs didn't lift a finger, and the fingernails of Mrs. Pharaoh were as immaculately manicured as Elizabeth Taylor's. It was built for centuries by anonymous slaves. Who were they? And Brecht asked the poem, when the Seven Gates of Thebes was built, who carried those rocks from one place to another? When the Chinese Wall was built, where did the masons go for lunch? When Caesar conquered Gaul, we got that in Latin one, all Gaul divided into three parts. When Caesar conquered Gaul, was there not even a cook in the army? And the big one is this. He asked, when the Armada sank, the Spanish Armada. I remember, I know that date. We got it in school, 1588, which is as indelibly imprinted in our minds as 1492 or 1776. 1588, we're told, Sir Francis Drake conquered the Spanish Armada. Did he do it by himself or what? And Brecht asked the question, when the Armada sank, we read that King Philip of Spain, wept. And here's the big question. Were there no other tears? And so the history I try to, I try to find out those people who shed those other tears. Who are these people who through centuries have shed those other tears? In other words, who made this world go round? Whose names we don't know about? Of. So that's more or less became my whatever it is I'm doing.
Well, when you read an extended remembrance from someone that you've run into walking on Division Street USA or someone who's remembering the good war, the Second World War, Is it that necessary that their remembrances be absolutely factually correct, and how can you ever know? Or is it just more important that in the way that their mind tells it to them this day, that this is the way it was?
Because, Ray, you're asking a very good question and a tough one to answer. Now, how do I know these people are telling me the truth? Someone says, this happened when I was at the front, or this woman when I worked at the defense plant during the war, or during the Depression when I lost my farm or lost my job. That person is telling me something, and I have to judge whether it's true or not. And as that person tells it, I know it's not something made up. It's a question that John Steinbeck asks one of his... He asks the hero, Tom Joad, in Grapes of Wrath, to ask someone else. Remember, the Joad family is on their way to California. They've been bulldozed off the land. The Dust Bowl got them, the Okies. And they're going to California, and they stop off somewhere. And some people are coming back from California, disillusioned, you know. And the guy said, I'd rather starve at home than starve out there. And he tells about his baby dying of heart trouble. And they said it was nothing but gas or something. And so someone said, is this guy telling the truth? And Tom, and Preacher Cajun says to Tom, he's telling the truth about himself, about us. We'll find out. So in a sense, it's like Tom Joad asking the question, are they telling the truth? Well, after a while, I add them all up, and yes, there's a basic truth they are telling. There may be a fact here and there, may not be literally so, I don't know that. But the basic truth of the Depression in the lives of these people, there's a common denominator. That's the role it played in their lives and how they behave today, or World War II, or the work they do. So it is memory that I bank on, of course, mine and the others.
If you're just joining us, that distinctive voice, of course, is Studs Terkel, the author of My American Century, a Pulitzer Prize winner, and an occasional TV and motion picture star. He joins us this hour from the New York Bureau. Our number is always 800-989-8255. If you want to join us, give us a call. We'll go first to Arlington, Virginia. Jerry, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Studs, I've admired you for years, and he just took my comment out of my mouth. Your voice stands, in my mind, almost as important as your views and your books. I hope we can computerize it so that my great-grandchildren can hear stories of America in your voice. I rank you with Richard Burton and Carl Sagan as having voices that I just absolutely want to sit down and listen to. Whatever you had to say, you could say, do the alphabet, and I'd sit down and listen to you.
Richard Burton. You got me. Thank you very much.
I'm not trying to build your ego, but it's just what I've always been drawn to is your voice. I automatically want to hear what you have to say. And as to your stories, I worked in the environmental movement for a while, until I sat down with coal miner families while we were fighting the strip mine bill to keep Appalachia from being ravaged. I didn't have that same depth of personal human experience of who provided the coal that lit the lights in my house and made me able to sit and watch my TV. And your books gained great meaning for me after that.
Well, thank you very much. You mentioned the strip miners. In one of my books, several, there's a man named Joe Begley. Who is Joe Begley? He runs a general store in eastern Kentucky, a ghost town called Blackie, along the hollers and the hills and the poverty. And Joe Begley becomes a center of activities, and he's made that town come alive again. They're challenging. It's a hard battle, of course. They're challenging the strip mine operators. And Joe is the kind of hero American I'm talking about. And you've brought that to my mind when you brought up strip mining.
Jerry in Arlington, Virginia, thanks for your call. We'll go next up the coast to Philadelphia. Kevin, welcome.
Yes, I myself, this is very timely because tomorrow I'm leaving for the University of Chicago, and I'm an aspiring journalist too, and I just want to know what Mr. Terkel thought about the kind of movement towards the global village and the CNN and the marketization of journalism versus the real lives journalism of Herb Kane and Charles Carroll that is sadly dying out.
Well, boy, you probably know my answer. You gave me a leading question. Of course, I'm frightened of the idea of the globalism. A global village idea is a good idea, the idea we're connected one with the other. You know, even my paraphrase, Hillary got it elsewhere, the idea it takes a village to raise a child, that's a good idea. You're talking about globalization, the market, free enterprise gone crazy, gone out of its noggin. There's a wonderful book named by Bill Greider on that very subject, One World, Whether You Like It or Not, something like it. It's the opposite of Wendell Willkie's One World, of a cooperative world, rather it's a competitive one. We use that word competition, and we finally becomes cancerous indeed, as it may be, in this matter of market liberalis.
Well, Kevin, you said you're going to the University of Chicago. You're ready for a couple of years of monastic-style life? The undergraduate run there is pretty tough.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I'm worried about. Like, I mean, I don't know if I like the kind of, like, the scholasticism versus the real life. And I prefer the real-life journalism versus the, you know. And I just wonder, I mean, I know that's dying out. And I know, like, you also mentioned John Steinbeck, and I just got done reading Travels with Charlie. And I know that sort of roaming the country-style journalism is kind of not idealistic and not really a pragmatic way to make a living, especially going into the 21st century. And I would just wonder what, you know, any advice to an aspiring journalist that wants to do the real-life kind of stuff, if that's, you know, it's not really a pragmatic thing to do, but what would you suggest to someone that wants to keep that style of journalism alive?
Yeah, it's a tough one. Well, take Ray Suarez. Here's Ray. He's on the network right now. Now, I admit he does not have the audience of Rush Limbaugh, or name the various other troglodytes you have in mind. Nonetheless, there's some. I think it has to be a question of enclaves. It may become too complicated. I think you seek out, you do the best you can. You want to make a living as a journalist, of course, and you break in any way you possibly can. You learn wherever you possibly, whether it be traditional or alternative. But eventually, I think you, if you are the journalist that you admire, the kind you admire, I think you have to be, to some extent, against the grain. But not so that you're out of a job completely. Somehow you have to survive. I'm aware of all that. But to question all the time, whenever you get something, the official word. One of the most horrendous examples of our giving everything up was the Gulf War, when all the papers, except for a few alternative magazines, allowed the Pentagon to dictate the news. This is true. It's common knowledge. They said, well, the Pentagon will tell you what to write, and so the coverage of the Gulf War, with exception, say, of the Nation magazine or the Progressive or things like that, they all caved in. It's that sort of stuff that frightens me and angers me.
But, you know, Studs, with the example of the Gulf War, one thing that was interesting was that this was not a case of the Pentagon shoving it down news organizations' throats or making them do something that they were reluctant to do. The rah-rah and the cheering and the getting in line was done almost voluntarily. And
you bet.
That was scary.
That's terrifying. You know, remember there was a young journalist on NBC. I don't mean to pick on any one network or station. John Alpert, his name was, a wonderful young photojournalist who decided to cover what was happening in Iraq. And some of our smart bombs were not that smart. They were rather dumb. And they fell on hospitals. And God knows how many thousands, scores of thousands of Iraqi kids were killed when the sanitation stuff fell apart and all. He was fired by NBC News for not being objective. There we come to that word again. He was not objective because he did something against the grain. He did something against what is authoritatively offered as truth. And so that's what we have to battle, I think, continuously. Always have, by the way, but now more than ever.
Kevin in Philadelphia, thanks a lot for your call. We'll go next to San Francisco. Hiya, Dave.
Hey, how's it going? Hey, I wanted to tiptoe a bit down the ribbon of time to the 50s. University of Chicago, I remember Jimmy's Bar, and right next door, right at the Compass Players later after A.J. Liebling to be Second City. And I remember listening to you there where during that period, they called the McCarthy period, where you used to play Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger where nobody else was. I remember Gene Shepard out of Gary, Indiana, talking about the steel mills. And then up to the generous side, Nelson Algren, Willie Motley, the Buckhouse Square, another enclave. And I wanted to mention why, because I believe he's never been mentioned, a one-armed Charlie Wendorf, the dean of the square then. And the College of Complexes. And this was me at 16 years old, and I believe that those were also some of your stomping grounds, weren't they?
Sure were. One-armed Charlie. Buckhouse Square, for those who are not from Chicago, has its, in London, it's called Hyde Park, an open forum that people talk about anything on a Sunday.
For the Newbury Library.
Next to Newbury, Buckhouse Square was an open forum.
And this is the McCarthy period, where free speech was frowned upon, to say the least.
Well, then it was knocked out of the box. It was knocked out of the box shortly after World War II. TV played a role. But in the days before that, everybody spoke, had soapboxes, and it was everything. It was comedy, it was politics, it was left, it was Moody Bible Institute, it was atheist, it was Sister Grace singing Amazing Grace and in a way demolishing the atheist with her good nature and good humor. It had everything. Mostly it had free opinions. One-armed Charlie Wendorf was the self-proclaimed mayor, the office mayor.
The square, they called him.
What's that?
The dean.
He was the dean. And one-armed Charlie
I'm taking back to about 1955, 56, when I was like 16 and first beginning to get out and listening to you. You had a thing called, yours was called Midnight Special, wasn't it?
Well, that was on WFMT.
You mentioned Tom Joad, and I believe you used to play Woody Guthrie's Tom Joad on there.
Well, the reason I came to this station, I had been blacklisted for a while because, as you may gather, I have a big mouth, and I speak out and don't apologize for it. As a result of which I lost a lot of jobs. One day I'm listening to this little FM radio station, and they're playing a Woody Guthrie record. Now, no one played, as you just pointed out, Woody except me. So I call up and say, I'd like to work with you guys. I had a sort of reputation then because Ray mentioned Studs Place, this TV show and other stuff. And they said, we'd love to have you on, but we're flat broke. And I am too. So we started even, and that was 45 years ago. So you're bringing back all kinds of memories that delight me, of course.
Well, Dave, back in San Francisco, maybe those memories won't get the hard knock that they'd get if you went to Buckhouse Square today and just saw all the gorgeous, very high-end townhouses and condos that now surround that park. It's unlikely that there would be a motley crew of orators there today. Dave, joining us from San Francisco, Studs Terkel is in New York. I'm Ray Suarez. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Ames, Iowa is next. Chris, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello, Studs. Congratulations on your 85th year.
Okay.
We all hope you for many more.
Thank you.
And I remember, specifically, I'll never forget it, sitting in your living room drinking martinis when you said to David Brower, those of us born in 1912, the year of the Titanic, have a very special perspective on the world, and I guess I'd like to hear you talk a little bit, just a few years now from the millennium, what you see as maybe some of the positive forces that are
I remember you. I remember you. You're that David Brower, for those who may not know. I assume they know who David Brower is. He's the enfant terrible at 85 of the environmental movement.
Yep.
He's the one who gets things going.
Yep.
And when a society he forms gets flaccid and dull, he quits it and forms another one, more militant than the other. And so remember, you mentioned the martinis. He said we both were 85, and he says he'll have the conversation with me on tape. He's in this last book, by the way, as well as a previous one about age. He says, I have it on the condition that he and I both have a double martini at that moment. He said, because we have a double martini, because God knows when we'll have the next. And so we did have a double martini, and did that fuel the conversation and make it live. As far as what we see, well, of course, he's one of those figures who's seen it way, way in advance, that the environmental movement has to be, of its very nature, tied in with every other movement, whether it be the peace movement, whether it be fighting homophobia, whether it be equality involving race, whether it be anything, or class, labor. It's all one. And what frustrates me is that very often they go off, each has its horse to ride. It's got to be one. We talk about third parties, and there's a new party, there's a Labor Party, there's a Green Party. There should be one national convention. They all agree on basic premises. on the basic things of life. And we know that the difference, there is a difference between the Democratic and Republican Party, as much as you can fit in a Tom Thumb's thimble. But nonetheless, there has to be, we're the only country in the world, major country, that has these two parties, and say, we just assume that's it. Was every country, industrialized countries, has 3-4 that are taken seriously one way or another.
But Chris also wanted to hear if you had any upbeat views of the future, whether you were optimistic about the future.
I do. By the way, this is a good question. I know, Ray, you asked this, and I don't want to lie. Am I optimistic or pessimistic? I am guardedly optimistic, and the key word is guardedly. So you wake up in the morning, and you see a headline, and, oh, God, Middle East, oh, God, Bosnia, oh, God, this, that, the other. They say, we're not going to make it. And then you run into individuals, all sorts. I don't mean just to think as you do. We know there's something else. Yeah, the species is great. The people calling up are not a minority. They do represent something that doesn't seem to be the popular view. They're not a minority. They're speaking out. Those who called me, I don't mean to just unduly flatter you, but those who call on this program are the ones who, in a sense, articulate what other people may feel but are inchoate. They can't express it. So I am hopeful to that extent, very much so.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Ray Suarez. My guest this hour, Studs Terkel. We're going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll take more of your calls at 800-989-8255. You can email us at totn@npr.org or write us. Talk of the Nation Letters, 635 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20001. At 33 minutes past the hour, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Welcome back to the program. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking today with Studs Terkel, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and broadcaster. His latest book is My American Century. President Clinton will present him with the Humanities Medal from the National Endowment for the Humanities later this month. If you want to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. Studs, since a lot of people probably aren't familiar with the TV show, I wanted you to talk a little bit about that because it was the kind of program that maybe we don't see that much of anymore. There was no script. You were doing live improv, because shows weren't taped in those days, that involved music, dialogue, set loosely in, what, a tavern, right?
Well, we have to remember, this was 1949, 1950. Television was a brand new medium. It's like, say, movies of in 1905. And so, because it was a new medium, it was not the powerful sales medium it is today. So it was not in the hands of ad agencies and vice presidents in charge of marketing. It was in the hands of the writer, the director, the actors. And Chicago was a center of this new medium. There were three programs that the preeminent TV critic of the time named John Crosby was a combination of Brooks Atkinson and Pauline Kael and all rolled into one. And he described these three programs as TV Chicago style. Three programs were Garraway at Large with Dave Garraway before he came to New York to be the very first host of the Today program. And Kukla Van Olly, and that was Bert Tilstrom, who was a genius of Chicago-style TV. And my program, me and my three colleagues, Beverly Younger, a wonderful actress who played Gracie the Waitress, a little restaurant, sort of. And she revolutionized the idea of a waitress until she came along. The waitress was gum-chewing Brooklynese, the stereotype. And she was an actress who traveled in stock company all over the country and saw these waitresses in little restaurants in mid-sized towns. Women who had a certain native wit, though not too educated, yet a native wit, she played that role. A man named Win Strachey was a friend of mine who was a leader singer, sing labor songs, and he could sing concert songs. And he was an old-time wobbly, too, IWW guy. He was a handyman who was self-educated. And the fourth was a piano player, blues piano named Chet Robel. Well, we four represented, it was my joint, and we four represented what was America, I said, without realizing it. We improvised the dialogue. There'd be a man named Charlie Andrews, who conceived the Garraway Show, conceived this program. And we had a page a plot, a page one day on Monday, and the actors would use their own experience and lives and dialogue. So how we got off on time, I'll never know, on Friday when we did it on the network. And we'd always say, we came to you from Chicago. I always say, dialogue by the cast. To this day, well, now it's forgotten, but until about 20 years ago, I was stopped by elderly women and guys on buses. Where is Stud's place? What's happened to the place? They thought there was a real place. I tried to tell them it's in our dreams, you know, it's in our head, it's in our heart. And so that was the kind of program it was, as was Cooper Van Hollien. And Garraway emceed that program in his easy style. It was free and easy. It was sort of like jazz in a way. It was improvisational. People thought it actually was real. But that was, then it all ended when TV became the hot sales medium. How can you sponsor a program that has no written script word or canned laughter? Canned laughter, my God. Of course not. The people were experiencing it at that moment they were seeing. If we pulled boners, it was a howler. It was live, real. So, of course, I have memories of that.
Deanne is with us now from Rock Hill, South Carolina. Hi, Deanne.
Hi. I just wanted to say that Mr. Turkle has been a real influence on me. I was first introduced to your work in high school about 20 years ago with the book Working, and then most recently The Good War was assigned in a history class as a way to do oral history. And I'm currently working on a master's thesis, which is going to be an oral history of German POWs held in the United States. And I had a couple of comments about your technique. It seems like you just seem to let people talk and get their story out, and I find that really fascinating. And also your earlier comments about objectivity versus the perception of the people that these things actually happen to. And for me, that was really a big breakthrough as opposed to studying the great leaders and troop movements. But the story of the little guy that these big events really had an impact on. And I was wondering if you would care to comment on that.
Well, first of all, a moment ago, Ray Suarez, do I have hope? I do, hearing you. Hearing you right now. You're about what? You're about, how old are you now? You're about...
Who, me?
No, she.
Deanne.
Well,
yeah.
Well, you're a kid in my book, of course. But the fact is, you are working on something right now, a project.
Right.
German POW, it's a fascinating thing. But mostly what you said about object and whatever... Naturally, I feel deeply moved and honored you're saying that. But you represent to me what it's about, too, that the note of hope there. I think it's not just letting people talk. Let them. They know, by there's no accident, that I'm not very good technically, mechanically. This figures. I'm about to tell you something. I use a tape recorder, right?
Uh-huh.
People say, Studs on the tape recorder. I haven't the faintest idea how it works. I goof up. I press the wrong button. I don't do this deliberately, but I just do it. And the person, this hard-working, non-celebrated person is there with a guy who's vulnerable, just like he is or she is, not someone from Mount Olympus come up from a network with a mic in front of you. And they realize, oh, look at that guy. And they say, look, the reel is, when I had reels before the cassette, that thing's not turning. I said, oh, I goofed. And when I say I goofed, I forgot, they helped me. And in other words, I need them. And I think to feel needed is very important to every human being, to feel needed. They feel needed by me. And I'm curious. And so as a result of this conversation and my goofing up, some accuse me of doing it deliberately. I don't. I can't drive a car, you know. You know, I was traveling, didn't have a credit card, poor credit cards, and I wanted to have a check signed at a hotel. They said, where's your identification? Where's your driver's license? I said, I don't have a driver's license. I have a library card. That's the worst thing I could say, a library card. Then and there, they knew I was un-American, you know. So as you see, I goof up. It's like a journey. I'm like a, I hate to use the word fellow traveler. I'm a fellow traveler with them on this journey in which they're telling of their lives, in a way. So that's what you are doing, to me, is very exciting.
Deanne, these soldiers must be getting on in years and getting harder to find. How's your work going?
It's going great. It's been incredible. I've learned so much, and I've made a lot of new friends.
Well, good luck with your work.
Thank you.
Deanne in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Jean-Michel is next in beautiful Cape May, New Jersey. Jean-Michel, welcome.
Yes, hello. I can't hear you very well, but I'd like to congratulate Mr. Turkle upon his for being awarded the Humanities Medal. I think it's about 25 years overdue. It's certainly on account of all the Republicans in the White House who really didn't get the idea. But actually, the question I'd like to ask is, as you are a child of the Depression, Mr. Turkle, I'm a devotee of the American cinema, and especially the films of Frank Capra and Preston Sturges. I'd like to know what films you think were made in those years which truly depicted the sufferings of the American people during that time.
Well, of course, naturally, I think of the adaptation of Grapes of Wrath, to me, if ever a picture of the time. As the novel was great, the picture was a marvelous capturing of it, very much so.
Excuse me, I really can't hear you very well.
Oh, don't you hear me? I was thinking, you asked what films, recall that time, the Depression. Immediately, I think of Grapes of Wrath, of course, the John Ford version of John Steinbeck's novel, which I thought was a very faithful and wonderful adaptation of it. That stands out, as well as, you know, Burgess Meredith died today. He was George in the film of Mice and Men. And Mice and Men was a marvel. The movie was awfully good, which leads to a subject, if you don't mind my, since this is jazzy, I like improvisation. George and Lenny were ranch hands, right, remember? They were day laborers. Well, today we have something called temps, something called part-time. They are George and Lenny's today, who are working in banks and law firms and, of course, the United Parcel Service. That helped win the strike. People recognize the fact that we all may become George and Lenny's, more and more temps, you know. The Temporary Employment Agency, Manpower Incorporated, has never been so busy as it is now. And so a temp, of course, has no benefits, has no seniority, has no security. And so George and Lenny's now are all over the lot. This is by way of answering your question in a roundabout way. Certainly think those two films, among others, represented that period so beautifully to me.
Do you think there's less of an impulse, or let's say that the budgets are now so big that there's... It's not that easy to get films made,
Ray,
that do run, as you say, against the grain.
Well, Ray, I don't want to be the old curmudgeon either. I haven't seen films lately. You know, a lot of good films are made, and the big development is quite obvious. I'd be an old Neanderthal and recognize independent film companies, where there weren't before. That's an interesting development. And a lot of good films I know being made that I just haven't seen. I'm thinking about the Depression films that our friend just brought up a moment ago. But I don't want to just condemn, because there are some, I know them, fascinating films being made by independent filmmakers. And I, by the way, of course, as you can gather, I like John Sayles very much.
Jean-Michel in Cape May, New Jersey, thanks a lot for your call. Temple is, well, like many people in Los Angeles, in a car right now. Hiya, Temple.
Hi, Ray. How are you?
Okay.
Studs, I just want to congratulate you and just say what an honor it is to have you, you know, with us still, speaking about the American dream and about all things American. You were just speaking of film in America, and I just recently saw a documentary film that, Studs, you actually are in, called Anthem. And I was listening earlier, and you had a comment from a caller that said he was... asking, you know, what, going into the 21st century, what can a journalist do to make a living in this sort of view of America? How do you present that in the 21st century? And I felt like this film, Anthem, really spoke to that, and you in the film really spoke to that about what is American. I was just wondering what your experience was on that film and what you have to say about that.
I forgot what I said. I don't remember what I said. I remember these two girls, they're pretty thoughtful. They came in the door, and there I was greeting them, and I just sounded off, pretty much saying what I've been saying through this hour, I hope.
Was this a recent project, Stunts?
It was just released. I mean, I saw it out here in Los Angeles just recently, and it was just, I mean... in speaking about these things where you know, we look at America, it really was taking the notion of the anthem, the American anthem, and really presenting it in the true voice of America, you know, the voice of the people, which, you know, exactly is what Studs has done for the past 60 years. And I just, you know, Studs had talked a lot about a lot of the things that he has been talking about in this hour, and I just thought it was a really great testament to the regenerative quality of America, that now we have these younger storytellers coming up, and they have this, you know, even though we can become cynical and we can become overwrought with all the technology and TV and film and, oh God, you know, another $70 million blockbuster, there's still people out there who are inspired by you, Studs, and inspired by your work, and inspired to make these sorts of stories that really talk about what is American.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Temple, thanks for your call. Temple calling us from a car phone in Los Angeles. Amy in Seattle, Washington writes, any ideas or suggestions on how to encourage the cultivation of even-handedness, balance in others, so that one doesn't wind up losing half a pop's possible audience and instead preaching to the choir? Coming out of your remarks earlier, Studs, on objectivity, it would be tough to walk that line and not end up with an audience that already agrees with you. How to keep everybody in the tent?
Well, that's a good one, of course. How are you not preaching to the choir? Now, everybody who called has called affirmatively, liking what I say. That doesn't sadden me. I feel very good about it. But I wish there... Now, maybe there are some. Here's the point. I think there are some people listening to this program who may not agree, and I hope they think stuff they haven't thought about before, might not agree with me, but who may hesitate in calling up because maybe they think I sound too authoritative, you know, with my big mouth and everything, and maybe may feel a little intimidated. I hope they don't. And if they do disagree, I sure hope they speak out and say it. Because I think this is, the big question is, preaching to a choir. I don't think NPR is that. It's reaching other people whose voices you may not hear calling up because they're afraid you might be treated, they might be treated the way Rush Limbaugh treats those who disagree with him, you know. And so it's not that. I wish they would call more, because I think that I'm almost certain they are listening, because it's, I find, for example, third world cab drivers listen to NPR all the time, and Chicago BEZ is a local station, as Ray Suarez knows. And the surprising number of the new people coming to the country who listen to national public radio, and those who are not new, who are really fed up now with the fact that it's one-dimensional coverage of the news and the difference between those who disagree, who are authoritative and have the big networks, is minuscule. And I think there is that audience out there. I'm convinced of it.
Studs Terkel is in New York. Cabbies, honk if you love NPR. Maybe you'll wake up somebody in your back seat. I'm Ray Suarez. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. How'd you get the nickname Studs? I know your given name is Lewis.
I wish it were what you think it was, but unfortunately, it ain't. I got the nickname. There was a novel by James T. Farrell, a series, three novels, about Studs Lonergan, a figure in Chicago of a wasted life. I love that book. It's not as great today as I thought it was, but it's a darn good book, and I loved it. My name was Louis, but they called me Studs from then on. But it got me in trouble. I must explain it. When I did Working first came out, and libraries pick up. Remember, listener said she got it in school. So I got a letter from a librarian in the South. Remember her name, Sylvia Cooper. She says, you know, the life of a librarian is not the most exciting in the world, but now and then has its piquant moments, as I experienced. The book Working came, one of my colleagues is a Jerry Falwell fan, Reverend Jerry Falwell and Reverend Donald Wildman, who, you know, censor books, look for dirty words to cut the books out. There's a couple in Longview, Texas that does it, and they terrify textbook publishers. And this one guy says to me, Miss Cooper says to me in the letter, said, a book was requested by one of our library customers, and I said, we don't carry pornographic literature. She said, what's the name of the book? She says, I believe it's called Working Studs by Terkel. And that is when I knew I had a bestseller. In any event, it's my joke for tonight. But that's how I got the name, though, Studs Lonergan.
Sylvia's with us now, a different Sylvia from your librarian. She joins us from Manhattan. Hiya, Sylvia.
Congratulations, Studs.
Thank you.
I'm of your vintage. I'm 85.
Well, we're the same, kid.
Yes.
Kiddo.
And bless you, and let's hope that both of us make it way into the next millennium, because our voices are very much needed out there. There's a lot of things that have to be done, and we, in our way, have to raise the consciousness of the younger people of a need for believing in humanity and not the bottom line. And I, for one, while I'm not all that well right now, I try to struggle over to as an avenue of expression to 8th Avenue and 56th Street McDonald's, where they have a baby grand piano, and I play for the people standing online for Icola, and they applaud. I get a standing ovation because they're standing online.
Sylvia.
Yeah,
Sylvia,
please,
you are, Sylvia, you are the greatest cleanup batter we could possibly have. And you know what? We can't lose with you in the box there.
Well, at least Sylvia also knows that she's guaranteed a standing ovation when she plays that piano. And that has to be one of the classiest McDonald's in America if they have a baby grand over on 8th and 56th. Studs, we're almost at the end of our time right now. I know you're leaving your radio program later in the year. Any regrets about that, or was it just
I better get one thing straight. Mm-hmm. I'm not retiring. I feel like the Virginian answering the villain who called my name says, "When you say that, smile." Oh, no, I'm going to work with the Chicago Historical Society. More of a challenge. I want to save all those thousands of hours of tape and create some programs for schools and possibly NPR, special commemorative programs, a lot of work ahead. Got to save these thousands of hours of these voices. Some of these ordinary people, anonymous voices, some of Bertrand Russell, of Martin Luther King, of other voices. And so a big job ahead, even more than the one I'm leaving. I do have a tug. Giving up that mic, it's like an umbilical cord being broken. But here's a new challenge ahead.
And when does that happen?
End of this year.
Oh, okay.
And so I'll work till the year 2000. I love the way I'm so arrogant thinking about age, 85, and I shall work till the year toes up on the job is all I can say. Until then, thank you very much, Ray. Thanks very much indeed.
Studs,
and those who called up, of course.
Of course. They help us produce this program. Studs, it was great to talk to you again. Studs Terkel, veteran writer and broadcaster. His latest book is My American Century. He joined us from NPR's New York Bureau. Talk of the Nation is produced by Ellen Silva and directed by Alana Hadler. The production staff includes Karen Weinberg, Cece Fadupe, and Tamika Artist. Our intern is Bibi Gushbegi. Rich Rary is the technical director, with engineering support from Marcia Caldwell, Kirill Wheeler, Manoli Wetherill, Stacey Abbott, and Robert Newhouse. We had help from librarians Tom Tuzinski, Ruth Schwer, Catherine Baer, Beth Howard, and Denise Chen. Pete Michaels is the executive producer. This week, the government approved exploratory oil drilling on land the president designated a national monument just last year. Join Ira Flatow on the next Talk of the Nation Science Friday for a look at the decision and the reaction to it, plus a private company's plan to mine near-Earth asteroids. In Washington, I'm Ray Suarez, NPR News.
This program is a production of National Public Radio. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or this broadcast station. NPR is solely responsible for this program. Tapes and transcripts of Talk of the Nation are available. Call anytime toll-free 1-888-NPR-NEWS. That's toll-free 1-888-NPR-NEWS.